From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Show me the money? Not these days. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. It's a game-changing year in the election business. This is the first presidential campaign season operating under new rules about donations, which allow unlimited funds to flow in from corporations, unions, and individuals. It's being called dark money because much of it remains anonymous. Throw in all the costs related to this year's elections, both presidential and congressional, and some observers are putting the price tag at between $6 and $12 billion. Whatever happened to campaign finance reform? On Reporter's Notebook, speaking of politics, how one grassroots effort is trying to get Americans back to civil discourse. First, the news.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point from PRI. With billions of dollars flowing more freely than ever before into the nation's political process, has the U.S. reached the point where money is all that matters when it comes to elections? The balance of power between big money, much of it anonymous, and the average voter is stretched more tightly than ever before thanks to recent court rulings that have chipped away at campaign finance reform and transparency. Want to know who's paying how much to which candidate? You may never find out. On Reporter's Notebook, Bring It to the Table, a grassroots effort aimed at getting average people from the left and the right talking about politics instead of arguing about it. First, this news update. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is wrapping up a two-week trip through Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Her last stop was today in Jerusalem, where she met with top Israeli officials to talk about ways that Israel and the U.S. can work together to resolve regional issues, including Iran's efforts to build a nuclear program. My guest today is Josh Rogan, reporter for Foreign Policy Magazine, where he writes the Cable blog. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, let's start. It was a big long trip across much of the world, but let's start with the Middle East, where the secretary is wrapping up her trip. What happened?
Sure. Well, today, secretary is in Israel. I'm meeting with Palestinian and Israeli leaders. She met with Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman. She met with Palestinian President Abbas. There's not really a lot of progress expected in these meetings in terms of restarting the defunct Middle East peace process. This is more of a Clinton checking the bases and making sure that there's no opportunities for progress that she's missing. But frankly, all sides are pretty entrenched in their positions, so we're not expecting a lot of big news. It does come only weeks ahead of Mitt Romney's planned trip to Israel, so you can draw your own conclusions about the optics of sending a top Obama administration official to Israel at this particular time. Over the weekend, she was in Egypt, and that was actually a very newsworthy trip. Hillary Clinton sat down with President Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood Party candidate who just got elected to be the first actual Democratic president of Egypt in many decades, and he's now engrossed in a bitter struggle with the Egyptian military over control over that country's government. And Secretary Clinton's goal here was not to take sides between him and the military, but to send a message to the Egyptian people that the United States is going to work with the Egyptian government, however it pans out, even if it's led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's a pretty newsworthy event just by itself.
And she also had some crowd response that wasn't quite as flattering. The crowds were yelling "Monica, Monica" at her, meaning
right.
Monica Lewinsky, right? That's old news.
Well, democracy is messy, and Egypt is no exception. There were hundreds of protesters. There was this crazy story in Egypt over the weekend that somehow the United States and the Muslim Brotherhood had brokered a secret deal to rig the Egyptian elections and bring the Muslim Brotherhood to power. I mean, it's a kind of a ridiculous notion on a few different levels, mainly because the U.S. doesn't really have the influence that would be necessary to rig the Egyptian elections. But anyway, this caused lots of unrest, and there were hundreds of protesters around the U.S. consulate in Alexandria, a building that Hillary Clinton presided over a ceremony to reopen, and they were chanting "Monica, Monica, Monica," reference to Monica Lewinsky, which is kind of a mean thing to do. And then they threw tomatoes and shoes at her motorcade. Listen, anti-Americanism in Egypt
throwing
is on the
shoes.
Rise.
Wow, that's been a while. I remember the last incident of Bush having a shoe thrown at him in Iraq, I think it was.
Right, in that region, that's pretty much the standard insult.
Ultimate sign of disrespect. Well,
yeah.
let's let's back the trip up a bit, because she had some significant things going on in Asia.
Right. So moving backwards, before Egypt, she was in Cambodia. Cambodia is where they were holding what's called the ASEAN Regional Forum ministers meeting. That's the leading international organization that groups together Southeast Asian countries. And this is a huge focus of Hillary Clinton's agenda, and her legacy is the rebalance of U.S. diplomatic presence and power into Asia and away from the other parts of the world. And high-level visits like these are a big part of that. But the big issue on the in discussion there was the battle between China and the Southeast Asian countries over who's going to run the minerals and the fishing rights in the South China Sea. And this is an issue that's been heating up for years. And the U.S. has become a main actor in this issue to sort of get the Southeast Asian countries to organize and to come up with a unified position that they can confront this big power China. And the Chinese don't like that at all, Anna, but this is part of the U.S. policy in Asia is to become a leader in terms of getting all the Southeast Asian countries on the same page so that they can confront China as a unified bunch and not be picked off on one by one by a bigger power.
Does that tilt sort of U.S. relationships in Asia towards putting the United States on the side of the ASEAN countries against China?
Yeah, I mean, the Obama administration will never put it that starkly, but that's essentially what's happening here. I mean, right, what does the U.S. stand up for? They stand up for principles of rule of law, of resolving disputes through multilateral forum, through coming up with systems that can guide maritime disputes rather than just letting every dispute evolve into a shooting match between Chinese ships and Filipino ships, for example. So the U.S. position is always to uphold principles and not to take sides. It just so happens that those principles also support one side, which is not the Chinese side.
And just briefly, we're almost out of time. Any news from her stop in Burma?
So she did not go to Burma. She met with Hillary Clinton was in Burma in December. That was a huge visit, first visit by Secretary of State in over 50 years. What she did do is she met with the Burmese president in Cambodia, and she deployed the first U.S. ambassador to Burma, Derek Mitchell, who arrived in Burma this week.
Thanks for that correction.
Yeah, no problem. But it is huge Burma news. The Obama administration removed all investment bans on Burma.
Okay. We're out of time. I'm sorry, Josh, to cut you off. Thanks so much. We'll be right back with To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with To the Point. According to a report filed yesterday with the Federal Election Commission, $140 million has been raised since April by Romney Victory, a joint fundraising committee created by Mitt Romney's GOP presidential campaign. It's just one of the latest calculations in a political season dominated by money. Who's got how much? Who's giving it? How much of it is given anonymously? And, oh, by the way, whatever happened to campaign finance reform? My first guest today is Ken Vogel. He's the chief investigative reporter for Politico. He covers the confluence of money, politics, and influence. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you.
Let's just start, because the news did come out yesterday about the money raised by Romney Victory. Let's just start with a look at Romney money and what's coming in.
Yeah, Mitt Romney Victory, like you said in the intro, is a joint committee, fundraising committee, set up by the Romney campaign, the Republican National Committee, and a few state party committees. And what it does is allow Mitt Romney to accept far larger checks than he was able to accept when he was merely a candidate for his party's nomination. The Victory Committee can accept checks as large as $75,800 per person, whereas when he was just running in the primary, he can only accept checks up to $2,500. And for someone like Romney, who has a wide network of big donors, this is a huge advantage. And it's allowed him to not only compete with President Obama, who has been able to accept joint fundraising checks that large for some time as a result of being his party's nominee, de facto nominee from the beginning, but in fact has allowed him to surpass President Obama. In the last 2 months in which he's had this joint fundraising committee up and running, Mitt Romney has raised in one case, $16 million more than President Obama and his committees. That was in May. And then in June, $35 million more. This has Democrats rightly worried.
Is that, do you think, just the effect, though, of what you point out, that Romney is out of the primary season as the de facto nominee? Or do political observers expect this to continue to be the pace of Romney raising more than the president?
Well, that's certainly a valid question. And there is some sense that early money is the easiest money to get to so-called low-hanging fruit. But if you look at his total donor roles, that is the folks who have given to his presidential committee before he became the de facto nominee and was able to set up this joint fundraising committee, there are still quite a few of them who have big donors who gave the maximum to the primary committee who have not yet given to this joint fundraising committee. And so I think it bodes pretty well for him. And that, of course, as you alluded to in the opening, doesn't even count the super PACs and these outside groups, an area in which Republicans have had a huge advantage.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think I feel I'm sort of playing the part of the average voter in this discussion today, because this is like a crazy network of a labyrinth of money and where it comes from and how many different ways you can give it and how much of it's public and how much of it's anonymous. Let's go on to the super PACs, the so-called super PACs, and who they are and what they do.
Sure. So there's a super PAC that was set up exclusively to support Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And this is a new twist, both in the sense that super PACs were not could not even be created. They're a new thing that resulted from a 2010 federal court decision, actually two court decisions, the more famous Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, and then a lesser known one called Speech Now versus FEC that actually led more directly to them.
Citizens United was that Supreme Court ruling. And
that's correct.
Okay.
And so that allowed for unlimited funds to be spent by unions, corporations, on political advertising of the sort that is more direct and hard-hitting than those that are the, quote, issue ads. And then the Speech Now case said that individuals could get together and sort of pool their resources and make these types of unlimited expenditures in a way that they were previously forbidden from doing. So it's new on its face overall. But then the idea that there would be a, quote, independent committee, which are these super PACs are required to be, their formal name is Independent Expenditure Only Political Action Committees, that nonetheless was set up exclusively and explicitly to support a single candidate is also a new idea. And that has campaign finance advocates crying foul, because they say, how can a committee be independent if its sole purpose is supporting one candidate? And that's exactly what you have with this Mitt Romney super PAC called Restore Our Future. It's being run by former aides to Mitt Romney who worked on his 2008 campaign. And everyone knows, all the big donors know, there's no secret. If you want to give more than is allowed under the federal hard dollar limits to support Mitt Romney and oppose President Obama, you go to this Restore Our Future. Of course, President Obama and his allies also have the super PAC. Same deal there, set up just to support him. But for whatever reason.
Yeah, Priorities USA is his
correct.
Super PAC, right?
Yes, and for whatever reason, it has been far less successful in raising money than Restore Our Future.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So we've seen in the campaign fundraising, Romney catching up and in fact, doing better than the president. On the super PAC front, we're also here. So you're talking about super PACs raising more money. There are also more super PACs supporting Romney than the president. Is that, did the Democrats inherently not like the idea of a super PAC, or are they just not as good at it?
There's a little bit of both. And in fact, in 2004, when we saw sort of a gusher of outside spending that came anywhere close to rivaling what we're seeing right now, this is pre-super PACs in the era of so-called 527 groups, Democrats were actually the ones who raised and spent a whole lot more money in favor of John Kerry and against President Bush in 2004 than Republicans did, although some would argue that the Republican 527 effort, the infamous Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, was actually more effective. Nonetheless, there is a sense that it's easier to raise this type of big money from interested donors, that is, those who have the ability to write these huge checks and have their own political advising teams, when you are the challenger trying to take down an incumbent, which, of course, is the case here for Republicans, was the case in 2004 for Democrats. And, enmity goes a long way towards motivating folks to part with these big checks. And, yes, there is also a sense that Democrats just by definition don't like this type of big outside spending in politics. They didn't like the Citizens United decision or the subsequent Speech Now decision. And so they're going to be a little more leery to give these types of checks. But I think now you're starting to see some of the big Democratic donors coming off the sidelines, maybe not as much as you see Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul, or other big Republican donors supporting Mitt Romney. But I think that gap will start to close as well.
Okay, so back to accountability. On the super PACs, those names of donors are revealed, right? They have to be filed with the Federal Election Commission.
Yes, but even there, there is the potential to obscure the original source of donations by setting up. We're getting there.
No, hang on, just one second. So technically, super PACs, which are supposed to be independent and not affiliated with a campaign, even though they seem to be obviously supporting individual candidates. So that's a level, and I could go and read who donated that money. Let's get to that next level with the so-called social welfare organizations, the nonprofits that operate as 501c4s and are regulated by the IRS. Now, that's a whole nother way that money is coming into the campaign these days. Can you explain that?
Yeah, these groups were always able to accept these types of large donations for what we call issue ads. And sometimes that's really just a thinly veiled attack ad. These are the ads that say, call John Kelly and ask him why he did not serve valiantly in Vietnam War as he said that he did. People say, well, technically, that is not advocating for George Bush's election or John Kerry's defeat, but most viewers kind of get that message. What's new now is that these types of groups are not restricted anymore, at least by federal election law, from taking that extra step and saying, John Kerry lied about his Vietnam War record, vote for George Bush or vote against John Kerry. We see some of them doing that, but we also see a lot of these issue ads. And again, these groups are perhaps more now than ever associated with a party or a candidate in a way that we haven't seen before. So, and they are often paired with a super PAC. So there is no mistaking. If you're a big donor, you want to give money, you don't want your name attached. If you know where to give, if you want to either take down President Obama, or if you want to help President Obama win re-election. Again, though, even though there are these 501c4 groups, these social welfare groups on the left, including one supporting Obama that's paired with the Priorities USA Action Super PAC, the right has been way more successful at this.
So technically, you're 501, you could have an affiliated social welfare group. Karl Rove's group, for example, American Crossroads, is the super PAC. But Crossroads GPS is the 501c4 that's affiliated with it. Sister organizations, right?
That's correct, yes.
So that 501c4 that's not required to name its donors could turn around and make a donation to its sister organization, and
right.
Effectively channeling anonymous money to an organization that isn't allowed, that would only have to say it came from this organization, not the individuals, right?
That's correct. And we have seen that. In fact, we saw that though President Obama has been a rather vocal opponent of these developments, a critic of the Supreme Court for its ruling, and then a critic of the operatives who have taken advantage of the rulings to channel this secret money into politics. Priorities USA, which is the 501c4 component of the pro-Obama super PAC Priorities USA Action. In fact, that exact type of transfer occurred where secret money, undisclosed money, was raised by Priorities USA, the 501c4, which then transferred it to the super PAC Priorities USA Action. And so we see this again on all sides. Perhaps the right has done it in higher volumes and more successfully, but it's not for lack of trying on the left.
Ken Vogel, chief investigative reporter for Politico magazine, thank you very much for helping us just try to lay out the landscape and make sense of it today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Before we bring in our next guest, we're going to play one of those campaign ads or one of those issue ads being aired by one of the super PACs. Or actually, this one is by Crossroads GPS. You can see how hard it is for me to follow this. It's a 501c4. It's a campaign ad that's been running, funded by them.
The weakest job-adding quarter in 2 years.
It wasn't supposed to be this way. Over 3 years with crushing unemployment, American manufacturing shrinking again. President Obama's plan, spend more. He's added $4 billion in debt every day. The economy's slowing, but our debt keeps growing. Tell him for real job growth, cut the debt. Support the New Majority Agenda at newmajorityagenda.org.
Okay, we were listening to, that was an ad being run by a group that just called itself New Agenda. Boy, like I said, it's confusing, but it's part of Karl Rove's group, Crossroads GPS. I'm going to bring in Bob Biersack, senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks money in politics. He was a staff member at the Federal Election Committee for 30 years. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, we've got another ad to listen to in a moment that has come from one of Obama's supporting groups. But that's an ad right there. Is that a new kind of ad in the political landscape that doesn't really come right out and say, you know, we're so used to hearing those ones, I'm Mitt Romney and I approve this message. That wasn't that kind of ad.
No, that's right. It wasn't run by the campaign. It was run by one of these, as you've said, C4 organizations. They're not really new. We've had this kind of advertising for a long time. In the 1990s, for example, it happened to be funded by the parties in those days because it was the national parties who could take these unlimited contributions from corporations or unions or individual people at that time. And they ran advertising that as long as it didn't directly advocate the election or defeat of a candidate, but it just talked about issues or in reference to those candidates, talked about their positions. Much of the spending, for example, in 1995 by the Democratic National Committee was using this kind of money with those kinds of messages, which set the agenda for the reelection campaign for Bill Clinton in a time when people thought that he was pretty much finished.
Okay, now just sort of in interest of political fairness here, we're going to play one more ad, and this one is from Priorities USA, which is, unlike the first ad, a C4, where we can't track the people who donated to it. Priorities USA is the super PAC supporting Obama, where technically we can track who supported that. So let's hear this ad.
Out of the blue, one day, we were told to build a 30-foot stage. Gathered the guys, and we built that 30-foot stage, not knowing what it was for. Just days later, all three shifts were told to assemble in the warehouse. A group of people walked out on that stage and told us that the plant is now closed and all of you are fired. I looked both ways. I looked at the crowd and we all just lost our jobs. We don't have an income. Mitt Romney made over $100 million by shutting down our plant and devastated our lives. Turns out that when we built that stage, it was like building my own coffin, and it just made me sick.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Okay, so that was the second of the ads that we're hearing. They're not being run by the campaigns themselves or even by Democratic or Republican national committees. We're talking to Bob Biersack, senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. I'm going to come back to you, Bob, after the break. And also we'll be bringing in David Keating, the president for the Center for Competitive Politics, to talk a little bit more about these types of ads, the influence that they are or aren't having, the people who are behind them, what we do and don't know, why the labyrinth of money and politics has become as complicated as it has. That'll be coming up in the second half of the show. And on Reporter's Notebook later on, people, if we can't all get along, can we at least sit down and talk about it? How a grassroots effort called Bring It to the Table is trying to get Americans talking to each other about issues that divide them. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about money and elections. Bob Biersack, senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics, tracks money in politics. You're a staff member at the Federal Election Commission for 30 years. We've heard two ads that were run by non-campaign affiliated organizations, a super PAC and one of the so-called social welfare groups. Those groups aren't supposed to be coordinating with political campaigns. They're just supposed to be running issues. But I got to say, as just an average person here, it just sure sounds to me like I heard an ad from a political campaign.
Sure, and that's the point. They're created by sophisticated people who have been in this business for a long time. They know how to make good campaign ads or election ads. It's actually the case that if you look for those specific words that we used to talk about as being as indicating that it's a real election ad, so it says vote for this person or elect this person or defeat someone else, those messages, those words are almost never used even when the candidate does run the ad. So there isn't very much difference. And coordination doesn't necessarily, we think of back rooms and smoke-filled rooms and people discussing, I'll do this
now and you do this later. It's really not necessary to do things that way anymore. The messages that campaigns are using are out in the public all the time. Strategies are pretty transparent. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand what kinds of focus the candidate has and how these ads might work. And so you have sophisticated actors now with lots of money from coming from lots of different directions who are able to play in this process.
Could you give us a little bit of historical perspective on this? I mean, aren't some of the things that are going on today things that could have gotten you convicted 40 years ago?
It depends. As a person, as an individual person, I could always spend as much of my own money on supporting or opposing a candidate independently. That's been true since the Buckley Supreme Court decision in the mid-1970s.
Okay.
So some of this has been going on all along. The difference now is there's kind of more of a sanction to it since Citizens United, since these other court decisions. It's clear that not just individual people, but corporations and unions and other organizations all can be involved much more directly. And so there's a new kind of impetus to be involved, to participate this way, that we haven't really seen before.
How much of it, you know, with all this money coming in and all these ways that it can come in and that it can be anonymous, and how big of an influence will this ultimately be in November? Does it change the landscape this season, or is it just more of the same?
We'll have to wait and see in some respect. There's certainly going to be much more intensity about this campaign and a lot more money spent than we've seen before. But neither one of these candidates is going to win or lose this election based on how much money they spend. They're both going to have sufficient resources to get their message across, and ultimately people are going to decide. It makes it a little more chaotic, a little more unsettled for the candidates themselves. They're very nervous, I think, about what could happen tomorrow when the environment is this kind of situation where things can change very quickly. So there's a lot more pressure to raise more money, which kind of creates this loop that's a problem.
But go ahead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, bring in another guest to comment on what you've just said. Bob Biersack is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. David Keating is president for the Center for Competitive Politics. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Okay, so on the one hand, I feel dwarfed as an average citizen, just dwarfed by billions of dollars out there being raised and spent by people, you know, this incredibly complicated maze that we're talking about. And on the other hand, maybe I feel kind of special that all that money is being spent to get me to vote one way or the other. I mean, what do you think about the money? Good thing, bad thing? Is it helping foster deeper understanding of issues? Or is it just helping, you know, get that candidate's name out there and trigger a vote?
Well, I think it's a good thing that people are excited about the election and they're spending money speaking to other Americans about it. Fundamentally, that's what we're talking about here. And not only about the election, but about the issues up before Congress now, the issues that will be up before Congress in the coming months, and the issues that the candidates are talking about. So all the speech is good, I think. It's a good thing to have more discussion of public issues. Now, the academic research on this is also very encouraging, which is that when there's more discussion, when there's more speech, when there's more advertising about elections, the turnout tends to be higher, because this is not too surprising when you think about it for a little bit. There's more controversy. There's more discussion of the upcoming election. So people tend to tune in and say, well, gee, what's going on? Maybe I should be paying attention to it if there's so much talk about it. So by and large, we think this is a good thing.
You know, we're talking about really outrageously large numbers here, you know, $6 billion to $12 billion. And you hear over and over again from you know, polls from American people, like, money in politics has gotten crazy and out of hand. So I'm wondering, you know, how you reconcile those sentiments with the idea that more money on campaign ads is a good thing.
Well, I mean, basically, this is how we run our country here, is that we did put the First Amendment into the Constitution to protect freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom of the press. So I think the authors of the amendment had a good idea here, which is the best way to guarantee our liberties, the best way to guarantee a government that's responsible and responsive and accountable to the people, is to let people say what they want about the government without being afraid of being put in jail by the government. And that's fundamentally what's creating this ability to to raise money and spend money and spend it on the election, spend it on issues before Congress. So, you know, what other system could we come up with? If you think of it this way, do we want members of Congress deciding how much we can speak out about our government? Do we want members of Congress deciding how much we can spend on advertising, criticizing people in Congress or criticizing someone who might be president? I think most people would agree, no, that would be a terrible idea. Well, the last thing we want to do is to allow elected officials to decide what we can say about them and how much money we can spend criticizing them.
Yeah, but what about the issue of proportion in all of this? You know, the changes in the rulings allow large amounts of money to come in anonymously, you know, at least leaving the perception that people with more money are going to be better heard.
Well, there's obviously this is true for many things.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a famous athlete and that person does an endorsement for a candidate, well, that's a very valuable thing for the candidate. It's worth far more than the athlete could give to the candidate directly today. They're limited to $2,500 per election. When Oprah Winfrey gets on and endorses a candidate, that's a huge windfall to the candidate. If someone like Bruce Springsteen does a rock concert and donates his services, the candidate can raise tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars, but Bruce Springsteen couldn't write a check for that amount. So yes, I'm not going to sit here and say wealthy people may not have more speech if they decide to donate their money that way. Obviously, it's true that they do, but there are other people who have other advantages in the speech process, famous people in particular, people that run newspapers, people that run TV stations, people that run radio stations. Everyone agrees that those media outlets can spend as much as they want. No one can tell them how they can tilt their coverage one way or the other, nor should the government be telling these stations and outlets and newspapers how they should be framing their coverage. But if you accept the idea that government can regulate how much individuals, just by getting together, whether they want to get together with, you know, some group like the Sierra Club or some other group that may work for or against abortion or anything, you know, who's to say the government should regulate how much those groups should be able to speak to fellow Americans any more than a newspaper or a TV or a radio station? And that's fundamentally where this is coming from.
David,
the other reason, one other thing.
I need to bring in another guest, but go ahead.
One other thing, which is, if the government weren't so big and didn't do so much stuff, then maybe people wouldn't be spending so much money trying to influence it. I think that's part of the issue, too. But fundamentally,
a little political message of your own there. Good job.
Yeah.
But I am going to ask you to hold for just a moment on those thoughts so we can make room for another guest. David Keating is president of the Center for Competitive Politics. I'd like to invite Elizabeth Wilner to the conversation. She's vice president at Candor Media Group's Canner Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. She's the former political director at NBC News. Thanks for waiting to join the conversation.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I want to refocus a little bit here. We've been talking about all the money and where it's coming from. Where's it being spent right now?
It's being spent on a very lucky about 42% of American households. That's the percentage of households who have seen at least one ad during this general election campaign. But really, the percentage is more concentrated than that. There are about eight states or nine states where both sides in the presidential race are on the air. Most of them are in the Midwest and the eastern United States.
And those are considered to be some of the swing states in the election, right?
Yes, swing states, battleground states, yes.
We're looking at, for example, Ohio, North Carolina, Virginia, Iowa. I have to say personally, I'm glad I don't live in those states and I'm getting bombarded by campaign ads. Do people actually, from your research, like pay attention to campaign ads, especially, hello, it's the summer?
Well, we don't do research on whether or not people are paying attention. We do research on how many ads are airing and how much money is being spent on them. And you know, I would assume, given how many ads are airing, for example, in Columbus, Ohio, they're seeing about twice as many ads right now as they saw 4 years ago during the 2008 campaign, and more than they saw in early September of 2008 when things really get hot. So somebody clearly thinks people are paying attention, or at least they're trying harder to reach people who may not be paying quite so much attention because it is summertime.
We got a chuckle here out of the fact that we've seen people joking on Twitter on how they can't wait to get out of Ohio for summer vacation so they can get away from the ads.
They're getting hit with quite a lot of ads right now. The stations are probably pretty pleased about that. Yeah.
I'm assuming the increase in ads isn't just a reflection of the intensity of the campaign, but an increase in the money that we've been talking about.
Well, I think that's true in that you are seeing more, you know, sort of what we consider major advertisers in the game right now than we have in previous cycles. You know, right now, in addition to the two candidates, you've got 9 different advertisers who are on the air or have been on the air in this general election campaign who have spent $1 million or more. So there are a lot more people in the pool. They are not all on the air at the same time, I would note, but they are definitely out there and on the air, yes.
We've got 2 of those ads that we're just going to play for our viewers so they can also hear. They have a slightly different tone than the ads that we played earlier in the show that came from super PACs and the so-called social welfare groups. Here comes one from each of the candidates.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
When a president doesn't tell the truth, how can we trust him to lead? The Obama outsourcing attacks, misleading, unfair, and untrue. There was no evidence that Mitt Romney shipped jobs overseas. Candidate Obama lied about Hillary Clinton.
So shame on you, Barack Obama.
But America expects more from a president. Obama's dishonest campaign, another reason America has lost confidence in Barack Obama.
The choice on taxes. Mitt Romney's plan, a 25% tax cut for millionaires, tax breaks for oil companies and corporations that ship jobs overseas, but a tax hike for 18 million working families. President Obama's plan, ask the wealthy to pay a little more so the middle class pays less. Eliminate oil subsidies and tax breaks for companies that outsource. 2 plans, your choice.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Those were both the candidates, obviously. Elizabeth Wilner from Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. You were also the political director at NBC News. I'm just wondering if you can draw on your long experience to tell us, you know, if it's what differences you see in the ads running this early this year, what types of ads, what's going on?
Well, you see more ads, in part because there are more advertisers. So you're seeing more unique advertisements on the air. Right now, the vast majority of them, in fact, I think, as of this moment, all of the ads on the air by the candidates and those other advertisers are negative spots. And like I said, very negative, very intense. And I would say, you know, from previous cycles that one difference is that ads are being rotated in and out at a much faster pace. You used to have candidates put spots on the air that would stay on the air for a month or 2 months or even longer. But right now, I think what's happening is that the campaigns and other advertisers have realized that putting out a new ad, just the act itself of introducing a new ad, is a media event, and it gets coverage, and it helps the campaigns drive the narratives they're looking to drive. And so you're seeing ads not only as, you know, a huge tool in and of themselves, but as a way to shape the narrative with the media coverage of the campaign, and that is different.
And one example, of course, would be the sort of very recent debate over Romney's experience at Bain, how long he stayed there when he left. Obama and Romney have been going sort of lightning fast on those ads. There's a new one again out today, I think.
Yes, there have been new ads each day for the past 5 days, and in fact, I think on Saturday we saw 3 new ads coming out. Most of them are about this subject.
We're talking to Elizabeth Wilner, Vice President at Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. I'd like to go back to Bob Biersack, Senior Fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics. It tracks money in politics. Can you step back a bit also, Bob, and sort of give us a sense of the sort of trending of this money, these ads, you know, the impact on elections?
As you said, it's happening much earlier this year than we've seen before, much more intensity in the level within those states where everybody assumes that the election is going to be close. And it's kind of like every regulatory scheme, I suppose. It gets more complicated and convoluted. You know, all of us have had trouble keeping track of these different organizations, how they're structured, what they have to do. For us, one of the most important things I think this year is going to be to try to follow up on the disclosure of the donors of the money. I think the Supreme Court assumed that disclosure of the sources of the funds was an important part of this process. There was, in fact, an 8-member majority in the Citizens United case that said that disclosure was important. So the devil's in the details and how these things get implemented. and the implementation here hasn't gone quite as people expected. So that's going to be an important issue going forward, I think.
And do you all track or have any sense also of you know, whether citizens are better off with more ads? We heard David Keating made a very, you know, strong argument for we all are better. It's more free speech.
I think the best political science research that I've seen over the years suggests that television advertising has a pretty short shelf life. It's effective when the candidates aren't really very well defined among voters, and so you can learn a lot about a person by both positive and negative messages. But television advertising is effective. It stays with people for a few days. At the end of the day, it's going to be the combination of this constant barrage. That's why it keeps changing and keeps coming over and over. It'll be a combination of this emphasis on media and then also really direct contact with people, which is expensive, but it's also more effective in terms of getting people out to vote and getting them engaged in the campaign.
Bob Biersack is from the Center for Responsive Politics. We're almost out of time. I have a quick question for each of our other two guests. David Keating, president of the Center for Competitive Politics. We heard Bob say that they're going to be pushing a bit more for disclosure of who donors are and what amounts of money they're giving. What's your quick response to that?
Well, the disclosure laws are already very robust right now. I don't think additional laws are needed on this topic. And the idea that there's secret donors... Well, there's already laws that are against that.
But wait, the 501c4s do allow anonymous donations that can then be channeled into a super PAC.
No, it's not clear at all. The law is you cannot, if you're a C4, you cannot be raising money for independent expenditures and not report that. That's the law today is if you raise money for independent expenditures, you have to report it. So, you know, if there are people breaking the law, then obviously... they need to be sanctioned for that. But the law is, if you raise money for these activities, it has to be reported. Now, it is true that C4s do take money from their general budget and have given it to super PACs. It's also true that C4s can spend money out of their general budget and run express advocacy, urging voters to vote for or against a candidate. But that is a group that's just spending out of its budget, and that's a different question. And on that, it's a very controversial and very difficult question about whether donors should be disclosed. And you go back to a very famous case with the NAACP versus state of Alabama, when Alabama tried to force disclosure of membership list on when they were trying to fight for civil rights in that state.
Which opens up a topic for an entirely other show, very much so. Just quickly, Elizabeth Wilner from Cantor Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. Briefly, what are we going to see in the months leading up to the election in terms of ads?
Well, quite frankly, it's hard for even us to imagine because we're seeing things so exponentially more intense now than we have in previous cycles. I think in the fall, people in Ohio and Virginia and some other states will simply turn on their TVs and they will melt, or there will be some sort of white light emanating from them. I think you'll continue to see largely this barrage of negative ads, with the exception around the Olympics, when you'll probably see the candidates go on the air with positive spots. They're very patriotic. I'm sure Romney will promote the fact that he was involved in the Olympics. But that might be the oasis of positive advertising for the summer.
Wow, so much to look forward to. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, in fact, to all of our guests for a good conversation today. Elizabeth Wilner from Cantor Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group, David Keating of the Center for Competitive Politics, Bob Biersack from the Center for Responsive Politics, and we were joined by Ken Vogel, Chief Investigative Reporter for Politico. Putting the discourse back in politics, how one grassroots effort is trying to engage citizens from the left and the right in good old-fashioned conversation. That's coming up in Reporter's Notebook. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. It's time for Reporter's Notebook on To the Point, which this week is our Red State, Blue State feature. It all began with a conversation over dinner. Julie Winokur's teenage son told his mom that she was the most intolerant person he knows. A shocker for a woman who's a writer and documentary film producer and who says she prides herself on being an open-minded person. But Winokur paid attention and decided her son was right, that she wasn't listening to people who didn't agree with her politically. The result? A lot of planning and one successful Kickstarter campaign later, she's launched Bring It to the Table, which aims to engage Americans in civil discourse about politics in public settings across the country. My guest is Julie Winokur. She's the executive director of Talking Eyes Media, a nonprofit company, and the creator of Bring It to the Table. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So tell us a little bit more about the genesis of this. And teenage sons say a lot of things, but that one caught your attention.
Yeah, well, I almost thought maybe he hadn't met enough people in his short life yet, because if I'm the most intolerant, he's got a long way to go. But that said, it was sobering to hear that kind of comment about oneself. You know, it certainly isn't the light that I held myself in, and I was very shocked to hear it come from somebody who loved me so dearly. So I did have to listen. I had to stop and think about what kind of reaction I was having to people who have different political points of view. And I think we all tend to point fingers and say, they're the problem. If they would stop digging their heels in, then we could get somewhere. And it made me stop and think, well, you know what, maybe I'm part of the problem. Because if I'm not listening, and I also see that my circle of friends with whom I agree politically are really, truly not listening, then we are all to blame, and we all need to step up and actually have healthier conversations and engage across the aisle.
What's the key to good listening?
Well, you have to be ready not to push back and prove the other person wrong. So when I take my table out in the field, everything is framed as a question. I'm not there to disprove somebody's beliefs. I am there to find out, why do you believe what you believe? So I think the objective is very different. I'm not there to say, hey, don't you understand you're wrong and I'm right and, you haven't read the facts on this or you haven't done your homework.
Let's talk actually about the listening that's involved. You said you referred to bringing your table out in the field. You raised more than $30,000 on Kickstarter as you kind of proposed this idea to people and said, wouldn't you like to support it? You're out on the road now. How long have you been out and what does the process of engagement look like?
Well, the table tour is, we're doing it in segments. We just came back from an 11-day road trip to Virginia and North Carolina. We'll also be going to the Republican and Democratic National Conventions and tying those two together with a road trip between Florida and North Carolina. We'll head out to Ohio in September and Denver in October, and we'll be building tours around those stops. And then we've been shooting a lot locally. I'm based in New Jersey, so we've done a lot of shooting in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and then we also have gone up to Rhode Island. So the priority right now is to concentrate on the swing states, primarily because that's where the push-pull is the greatest. And in essence, we do a lot of pre-production. We have a plan. Once we roll into town, we know locations where we will set up our table because we've gotten prior approval. We are really looking to get diverse voices, so we are looking at the demographics in the places that we go. We've taken our table to a Baptist church in Winston-Salem and then to a mosque right across the street. We spent 4th of July in Faith, North Carolina, which is a town of about 800 people, but draws in tens of thousands for the 4th of July.
We've actually got a soundbite from one of your interviewees that I think is sort of an interesting framing of the conversation. Let's just listen to it.
Tell me, how do you identify politically and why?
I consider myself a conservative. Why? It just philosophically, that's where I'm the most comfortable. But I'm not like a lot of my hardcore right-wing friends. I don't see the government necessarily as inherently evil. I just think it's pretty inefficient and oppressive at times.
I'm curious if this man was representative of the people you met in terms of being, not an extreme one way or the other, or if he was an unusual interviewee.
I would say actually the majority of people who sit at the table have very nuanced beliefs, and that's really the big lesson from this. That people are not monolithic in their belief system. One of the questions I ask at the table is, what in your beliefs crosses over to the other side? And it's rare that somebody sits at the table and doesn't have some piece of their outlook that is either more conservative or more liberal than their politics would get, lead you to believe. So that's actually pretty typical. And this fellow ended up, you know, having a lot of meaningful commentary where the longer he talked, he ended up by the end of the interview saying, you know, I'm probably more of a libertarian than a conservative. So he kind of, in the thought process, and the more he was asked to express his beliefs and all of the contradictions within, he ended up kind of going through his own process right in front of me.
And you'll be able to see some of these conversations and comments at the website bringittothetable.org. That's all the time we've got to talk today. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Julie Winokur is Executive Director of Talking Eyes Media, and she's the creator of Bring It to the Table. Today's program was produced by Katie Cooper with Sonia Geis and Anna Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.